I'm with Elaine Ayagata. And Elaine, why don't you just tell us a little bit about yourself, what you're doing? And I know you have someone special that you want to introduce us to, your Aunt Ada. So why don't you start with yourself and we'll go from there.
Thanks, Carolyn. Yeah, it's kind of cool. And it totally starts when I was little, growing up in Walpole, Mass, which is 18 miles south of Boston. And she was in Canton, Mass, which was the town next door. And she was my grandfather's sister. So she was my great aunt. And, I grew up in that area. Walpole's a great town. I was an internationally award-winning artist before I was out of high school. Very creative, went on to college at the Art Institute of Boston. And it's funny, I had a writing class that I took, and Professor Wonkinen, Robert Wonkinen, was the professor, and he grabbed me at one point, and he was pretty adamant about me switching majors, and into writing. And I had never considered that, although I love to write, I just had never considered that. And I wasn't really sure. He wasn't trying to pick me up, so I kind of just thanked him and turned and walked away. But and he grabbed my arm and he said, "Elaine, I want to tell you something. I only met one other guy in all the years I've ever taught that's a natural like you, and I want you to really listen to me." And he said something that I have remembered all these years later, and even include in the back of the manuscript that I wrote. He said, "If you do not write full time, it will always be an angry mistress on the side." And I was just, I it floored me then, and it honestly just floored me even now. So fast forward, that's 1981, so I mean, I didn't switch my major. He remained furious at me, and we life went on in drastically different, directions. And but when I was a kid, I loved to weed. And I would just weed everything. I've weeded miles in my father's garden, whatever. So when my mother would drop me off to be babysat at Auntie Ada's, I would weed all day. And they had a crushed stone driveway. It was all crushed stones and weeds naturally landed in there, from the air. And I was constantly, but they had flowers everywhere. My great grandmother had just like outrageous flowers all over her yard. She had beds and beds and beds of just, it was just a thing to behold. So a full day of weeding, Auntie would always try to pay me. And I would say, "No, tell me that story about the big boat. And that's how you can pay me." And she would always enthral me about this story, like when I was really little, about the big boat, her being part of this rescue and the way she told it. And, one night we turned on the lights and she would just make it come to life the way she told it. Her face would change when she told it. It's almost like she would go back. But as a kid, I didn't pick up on those little things. And then one particular night when I was over there after weeding, she goes, "Elaine, I'm going to tell you a piece of this that I never told before." I said, "Auntie, what is it?" And she was like, "The name of the big boat is the Titanic." And I said, "Oh, wow. Okay." So I just was like, "Okay, slowly tell me the story again." I mean, because I, as a kid, just as a kid, there was a particular book in the house that we were not allowed to touch. Like we would be on fire if we ever touched it. "Nobody's allowed to touch this book on the Titanic." It was a first edition book about the Titanic, and it had such reverence in our house. And I was like, so it, automatically as a kid, I was already, phenomenally enthralled by the Titanic. So when she ever told me that was the name of the big boat, I was like, "My God." So then when she would tell me the story, I just was blown away. My mother would pick me up in the car and, I'd be driving home and I'd be like, just wired, telling the story. And she's like, "I know about Auntie's story, Elaine. I know about Auntie, and it's funny because all the other little cousins were like, "Yeah, they heard it once and ran off." And I was just the one that never ran off. And it's funny because every time she would then tell me the story, she'd let a little crumb slip, little new piece, a little nugget, a little this, and I would build a trail. And I was taking all these little gold nuggets and storing them like a squirrel in the fall, and just and I'm t and then I understood why her face would change and her countenance was different. And at one particular point, she always stopped talking and just almost froze. And it was when the guy died in front of her that was very dramatic. But I mean, and I just I could not hear the story enough. And the sad part is, go forward a few more years. I think I was in junior high. I'm pretty sure she passed away in 1976 or so, around there. And I was in junior high. Whenever that generation would make dinner, they would always put an apron on. They just would. Okay. And so she had long hair. And when she pushed her hair, away from her right hand shoulder to put the apron on, I noticed like a half orange sized lump on her shoulder blade in the back. And I knew nobody else had a lump there. I knew that was wrong. Even in junior high, I didn't know about cancer and who does, when they're really young. And so I didn't say anything because my mother and father taught me manners. You just don't say stuff. So when my mother went to pick me up, I kissed Auntie Ada, and I was all wired about the story again. But I said, "Mom, Auntie Ada's got a lump. I noticed a lump." And she goes, "Oh, Elaine, you're the artist in the family. You and all these." And I said, "No, listen, Mom, the next time you drop me off, when she pushes her hair back, tell me if you see it. And when you kiss me goodbye, whisper in my ear if you see it." And sure enough, like a couple weeks later, we went back, and that was unfortunately the cancer that pushed her into an early grave that no one else had detected. So the amount of time she ever told me this story, then I just was the only one that carried this full library of memories. I just remember it was just a very special thing. And then fast forward, college, you get married, you have a kid, stepkids, whatever, and life just goes at a different velocity. I never really opened that box, but I'd always just, say it one time, somebody'd be like, "Oh yeah, what about this? What about that? Well, my great aunt helped in the," and I'd always pull out, a tiny little nugget, but never really the whole story. So fast forward to 2019. I'm single, and I was then too. And I'm on a Bumble date, and I'm fumbling through Bumble, and I'm out on this guy's boat. He's a wonderful guy in Manchester by the Sea, up in the north of Boston. Beautiful port, and we've just docked the boat, and we're out in the harbor. And it was Sunday, before a surgery I had coming up on Thursday. And I didn't want to scare him off, having a major surgery on Thursday. I told him I was going in for a little tune-up. But I was getting 20 inches of scar tissue cut out of my colon from a previous colon cancer event. Yeah, I mean, I didn't want to scare him that I might die on Thursday. So, but we're out in his boat. He drops the anchor and he goes, "Let's play That's Amazing. You go first." And it's a first date with a guy. I really can't be that, transparent with him on, "That's Amazing." So I joked and I said, "Well, if I knew you any better, I could entertain you for hours." So, I mean, we both laughed and he goes, "No, seriously, you go first." He goes, "You're very animated. Your food pictures are amazing. You're seemingly an amazing chef." He goes, "I just, you're an artist. Go ahead, you go." And I said, "That's easy." I said, "That's amazing." I said, "Aunt Ada was on the rescue ship. She was on the Carpathia, and for the Titanic survivors." And he just stopped. His face froze. And I said, "Hello?" And he goes, "You never wrote that? You can't be this much of an artist and you don't write." I said, "Well, I enjoy writing. I just never did it for a living. I what?" And he goes, "Well, listen, you said you're having a little tune-up on Thursday. What happens if you just don't make it? Anesthesia is anesthesia." And then there was like a lightning bolt that came right through me. And I was like, "My God, I am the only one carrying this library. And what if something happens?" And then to reiterate it further, he goes, "You actually don't have a right to take this story to your grave." Okay. So I won. That was amazing. He goes, "I'm not even going to go. I can't compete with that." He goes, "Let's go to dinner." And then in the middle of dinner, he stopped again and he goes, "Elaine, you really have to write that. Whether we date each other or anything," he goes, "it's bothering me that that's a powerful story." So on the way home, I just was like, "Wow." So the minute I got, I woke up from the surgery, I literally took my own IV out and got the hell out of the bed, and just I couldn't wait to get home because I was like, "My God, I was obsessed. I really became obsessed about getting this out, and I was so grateful that God didn't take my life, at that, anesthesia event." And I had like this mission. However, I had a 1 foot vertical scar and all kinds of real problems physically. And I had a medical girdle that I couldn't even breathe in. And they're like, "You got to lay down flat for 8 weeks." And I'm like, "Just get out of the way. I got to write." So I literally sat in my bed with the six Italian greyhounds and my big cat Rocco. And I rode from like 6 o'clock in the morning until like 1 o'clock in the morning. I just got up to tinkle. I wasn't on any kind of painkiller because that would have constipated me. So I was having popsicles, and just so I would tinkle. And it's all I did was have popsicles and write. And I it was like I levitated. It was just like something came over me, and this story poured out of my arm like the water from a hose when you put a, when the firefighters put a house out. I mean, it poured. Sometimes her memories would come so quick, I couldn't type that fast. I would end up typing hieroglyphics. And then after, you know, that memory was out, I'd have to go back and discern what I had written because I partially typed a word, and then I just, and it was just because sometimes it would come to me so rapidly. But the beautiful thing about writing it in 2019 versus writing it in 1980 was Google. I mean, I'm like, okay, the woman with the broken knee that was in Molly Brown's boat, they were rowing. And the minute I put in the shards of glass, the entire vase came up for who this woman was. And I'm like, oh. So the resource that Google was during my research was astonishing. So, I mean, I connected what she had told me and populated it with my research, and the whole story just came to life. And I was completely obsessed about it. So at that point, you know what, you know, after a while, quite a while, I put my proverbial pen down, you know, after I was done, and many times my hair would be up on my arms for a long time. I couldn't get it down. I would be hysterically crying. It would just evoke just the emotion of her story. I mean, I know what it did to me, and I was writing, I was typing. And so I just felt like I had something amazing when I was done with it. I knew I did. I just had a gut feeling. And so I really shouldn't have at all physically. And I never told my doctors I did. I got out of bed longer than a tinkle and got in my car and sent the file to Staples to have them print it out. And I wasn't aware of how heavy this was going to be because it really, at this point, was as heavy as a, it's a big manuscript. It was, I said, you got to bind it, spiral bind it, and make it like a real book. You can't give it to me loose, you know? And when he gave it to me, it was so heavy. I'm like, my God, you use all your abdominal muscles to carry. I'm sweating profusely. And he goes, ma'am, are you okay? Because I'm bent over. I shouldn't have been out of bed. I'm really not well. And I don't want to get too graphic, but things are bleeding. And, you know, and I'm like, my God, you know? So I get back in my car, I get back in the car, and I'm like, and, you know, my really wonderful friend, Kathleen Spivak has taught all over the world writing and poetry, and she's published many books. And her father is Peter Drucker, who published 35 of his own books, and he was the father of the economics program at Harvard. She lived about a mile from my house in Belmont in Watertown. So I literally had it printed in Cambridge, went to her house in Watertown, and was in a catastrophic physical state, trying to just get to the back door up the stairs to give her the manuscript that she had no idea existed. So I go in the kitchen and I'm not doing well. I'm way over what I should be. I really, it was such a great mistake to be out of bed. So, you know, she's, I said, look, I wrote a book, and she just came out yelling. She, I get somebody coming from Iceland. They're a great client. You got to get out of here. Elaine, you got to get out of here. What are you even doing out of bed? So I was like, I said, listen, listen. And I'm sweating profusely. I'm a total catastrophe physically, and everything's in pain, throbbing, and bleeding. And I put the manuscript on the bed, and I mean, on the table. And I said, I wrote this. And she goes, get that out of here. She goes, you're not a writer. You're an amazing chef. You're an artist. You're funny. You're not even a freshman writer. Get out of here. So I was like, wow. I mean, so I pushed it on the floor because there's no way I'm carrying that back to the car. I shouldn't even be in the car. So I mean, I was like, I pushed it on the floor, and I said, listen, and she's screaming. And I said, listen, grab 5 pages a night and burn it for kindling in your fireplace. I'm not carrying it back. So she's screaming. I'm going down the back stairs, holding onto the rail, going, my God, my God. I barely get back to my house. I got in bed, and I just laid there and burst into tears because I was in such agony. And I'm like, it just even hurt to breathe. And I'm like, God, was that a catastrophically stupid thing to do? So I'm like, so one day goes by. I didn't even move. I'm like, I couldn't even call my doctor and tell him what I did. I couldn't even do that. And I just was in trouble. I'm like, oh God. So basically, one day goes by, 2 days go by, and I'm like, is she burning that? Is she burning that? Two and a half day goes by and it's quarter of midnight. I mean, I'm just laying looking at the ceiling, like if, and all of a sudden the phone rings and she goes, are you fucking kidding me? And I literally said, what side of the fence are you talking about? Are you fucking kidding me? Are you fucking kidding me? Which one is it? And she goes, this isn't a book, Elaine. This is a book movie deal. And she goes, let me tell you about my life. This is what's going to happen to you. She goes, it's going to take you a year and a half to 2 years to find a literary agent. However, they're necessary parasites. And I had never heard necessary next to parasite before. She said, they're necessary parasites because they will go to a publisher and kill them for a great deal and get you a great contract and then take 15 to 20%. But if you go in without an agent, you're going to get bent over and just, it's not going to go well. And that's just my industry, Elaine. I don't even know if my agent's still alive. I mean, he was an elderly guy when I had him, and I said, all right, I can do it. I'm good. I can do it. So I'm in bed, is still in agony from that episode 2.5 days later, but I was so like invigorated. I'm like, how the hell do you get a literary agent? So I just, and then I started my quest. And then I banged into COVID. And it's not easy to find a literary agent that will take a gamble on a first-time author. That they don't want to have somebody that's, a maybe. Is it going to be a one-hit wonder? But the reality is right now at the moment, and today is May 19th, 2024. The manuscript is, when you give your manuscript to a literary agent, they can take 4 to 8 weeks to get back to you. It's just shut up and get in line. You can't go, where are you? What page are you on? You can't act like a human fruit fly and bother them. You just got to leave them alone for 8 weeks and just chew your fingernails and your hangnails and wait. So, yeah, I mean, so now I think I'm at the 7th week and the manuscript is in front of a tremendous literary agent in Manhattan with a phenomenal firm that's been around since the 70s. It's not some brand new wobbly startup. I'm just excited. They've had several New York Times bestsellers. I've always thought this was. The cool thing is, for 112 years, it's been an astonishment for me that when you talk about the Titanic sinking, it's always a one-sided talk. It's the Titanic, the Titanic, the Titanic, the Titanic. No one ever, for 112 years, have really talked about the Carpathia. Which is amazing. It's just so the manuscript, with the potential of turning into a book, Broadway show, movie, has the potential of sitting in a chair in history that's been empty for 112 years. That's dynamic and very cool. And it's kind of a God wink. I mean, anybody in 1940 could have wrote this story. I mean, I re in the 70s. I mean, in 1920, so I mean, it has sat untold, since 1912. And it's a powerful story. The Titanic as a movie was one of the top grossing movies of American movie history. And it's really a work of fiction. Those main characters are those, that's a wonderful, elaborate work of fiction based in the greatest maritime tragedy the world has ever known. But this is not a work of fiction. This is a real person I knew, and it's powerful. I also think the Titanic never dies. I always say the ship may have sunk, but that it never died. Even with the submarine that, the immersible that collapsed upon itself and those five people, it cost them their life, just trying to get a glimpse of the wreck 112 years later, paying over $100,000. Books are still coming out about the Titanic this spring. This is just always a fresh batch of anything Titanic is always a headline grabbing event. And so it's going to be very exciting to reveal the vantage point of the other boat on that particular night. So I think we're in a cool spot. It's been a challenge to get here. I really don't even, now that I look back, I don't even know how I ignored physical pain like that and wrote it, but it was just, it's almost like I levitated and wrote it and ignored everything. And I'm grateful for the Bumble date. I'm grateful for all the things that happened because it never would have come out. I don't think I would have arrived at, let me pull over and write today. Let me try this. It's amazing how God made these dominoes fall down right until today, for this, for us to be exactly right here today, right now.
Well, excellent, Elaine. That's it sounds like an exciting story, and I look forward to hearing more. Thank you so much.
Thank you.